Tariq Ramadan has been called the Muslim Martin Luther King, and he's often described as Europe's most important Muslim intellectual. The Swiss philosopher travels throughout the Islamic world, trying to build bridges between European Muslims and conservative clerics. Some countries, including the United States, have banned him. A few years ago, Ramadan was all set to move with his family to Indiana, where he'd accepted a teaching job at Notre Dame. But the U.S. State Department revoked his visa. Ramadan says it's because he's an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign policy. His critics say he has ties to Muslim terrorists, though no evidence of a direct link has ever surfaced. One reason Ramadan gets such close scrutiny is his family background. His grandfather, Hassan al-Banna, founded Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, the group that later spawned top leaders in al-Qaeda. Tariq Ramadan resists simple labels. He's a devout Muslim, but one who wants to loosen the strict interpretations of Islamic law. Now he's written a book about Muhammad called In the Footsteps of the Prophet. Ramadan told Steve Paulson that Muhammad's life offers many lessons for today's Muslims.
You know, the Prophet's life is really an introduction to Islam. So when you listen to people, the perception they have, it's all about violence, it's all about otherness, it's all about, you know, discriminations towards women. And I think all this is wrong.
Well, let me ask you about women, because that is clearly something that you have, one of the points you have emphasized in this book. I mean, the picture that you present of the Prophet is someone who had a very forward-looking attitude about the status of women. What lessons can Muslim women take away from Muhammad's life?
I think first, really, he was respecting the very status of women. When his daughter was to come to him, he was to stand up and to welcome her, to talk to her, to respect her, to kiss her in front of the people for them to understand that this was something which was really important. And at that time, to have a daughter in this, you know, Arab tribes was something which was quite a dishonor. It was not perceived as something which is valued in the society. He was just sending another message. As to the mosque, at the same time, he was just welcoming women in the mosque and let them enter, talk, being present in the mosque.
So you're saying that those rules in certain Islamic countries prohibiting women from going to the mosque, those are wrong. I mean, if you look at the life of Muhammad himself.
Yes, exactly. What you are doing by preventing Muslim women to enter mosques is not Islamic. What you are doing by preventing them from getting knowledge is not Islamic. What you are doing by forcing them to get married with someone they haven't chosen, this is not Islamic. You know, forced marriages are not Islamic. And even domestic violence, people are saying they can't just quote one part of a verse in the Quran, of forgetting that the Prophet himself never beat a woman. He was so respectful. So if he is our example, we cannot accept domestic violence. This is not Islamic.
Well, let me ask you about the prescription on prayer. Can you be a Muslim in good standing and not pray?
It's a discussion between scholars. I'm not going to say, no, you know, praying is not an obligation. No, there is a prescription saying 5 prayers a day, but now it's you to decide you want to pray or not. It's you to decide in which way you want to practice.
But I guess I'm not sure what that means, though. If there is a prescription to pray 5 times a day, but it's up to you in the end to decide. I mean, if you don't pray 5 times a day, have you sinned then? I mean, have you violated some sort of core Islamic principles?
Violated, I will not use this term, but I would say you know what you have to do as a practicing Muslim. This is your responsibility. But there are norms, yes. A practicing Muslim who wants to do all his duties before God should pray 5 times a day. Now, you cannot impose on anyone to do it, and you cannot say, because you are not doing it, you are a bad Muslim. As to judging your heart, it's not of my business. It's between you and God.
I want to ask about your own background, because you have a very unusual academic training, including 2 PhDs, one dissertation on Islam, the other on Nietzsche. You have lived in several countries, in both Europe and in Egypt. How do you think about your own identity? I mean, how do you define yourself?
I would say I am Swiss by nationality. I'm European by culture. I'm Egyptian by memory. I am universalist by principle, and Muslim, of course, by religion. So it's 5 dimensions of my identities, but really over all these universalist by principles.
Let me ask about Egypt, because you went to live in Egypt for a while, the country of your parents, and what I've heard is that you felt out of place there and realized that Europe was your real home. Is that true?
Yes, that's totally true. I was living in Europe, and I'm a son of a very difficult exile for my parents. They left the country because of political reasons, and they were just dreaming to go back there. And I started idealizing my country of origin. I went there, I studied there, and I felt that, no, it's not that. I'm no longer really, really Egyptian by culture. There is something very European in me. So I felt the gap.
So do you see your larger project as finding common ground between secular Europeans and conservative Muslims who live in the Middle East? I mean, is it trying to build an understanding about Islam that can be acceptable in both places?
I'm not trying to do something which could be acceptable. I think that we are dealing with a clash of perceptions, not a clash of civilizations. And I think that I want to deconstruct these perceptions to come to the common roots. So I'm not trying to make Islam more acceptable. There is no point. I don't have to do this. You know, in fact, my project is much more about reconciliation.
But it does seem to me that there are different issues that come into play for Muslims in Europe as opposed to in the Middle East. I mean, one of the major differences is that Islam is a minority religion in countries like France and England, and in most Middle Eastern countries, there's no effort to separate religion and politics. In Europe, especially in France, there is an absolutely strict separation, and a lot of people wonder whether Muslims can live comfortably as a minority, or is there an inherent drive within the Islamic tradition to become the one dominant religion?
Look, millions of Muslims are already showing every day that they don't have a problem. If you look at your situation in the States, you have millions of Muslims that are living as quiet, peaceful American Muslim citizens. They don't have a problem. Even in France. In France, 5 million Muslims are living in France. Half of them are already French. They don't have a problem. The problem of the French Muslims is not the secular framework. The problem is that in the suburbs, they are dealing with discrimination, social problems, social marginalization. It has nothing to do with religion. When we had the riots in the suburbs in November 2005, you had politicians speaking about them as if they were not French citizens. So I really think that all this perception and construction of Islam and Muslims cannot live in secular society first is totally wrong. Millions are already doing it, living it, experiencing it.
Well, it seems to me you are clearly a voice of reform within the Islamic world. Many people pay attention to what you say, both in Europe as well as in the United States and in the Middle East. Do you see this reform movement in Europe as being something that perhaps other Muslims from around the world will look at and follow?
Yes, of course. And I think it's really already happening. For years and decades, we had our answers coming from, you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, from the great Islamic traditional centers of knowledge. But now it has changed. You know, I'm traveling a lot in the Islamic majority countries, to Morocco, Jordan, Indonesia, Africa. You know, this call for a moratorium that I launched 2 years ago, at the beginning I got so strong rejections.
The moratorium on the Muslim edict about stoning women who have committed adultery.
No, but not only. By the way, you know, stoning women is much more a Christian approach. In Islam, it's stoning about adultery men and women. But it's not only about this. It's stoning death penalty and corporal punishment. At the beginning, I was criticized by so many Muslims, and even in the States were saying, what are you talking about? And then with years, you know, discussion, I went to Morocco. I sat with 40 scholars. I sat with scholars. Even the Mufti of Egypt responded 3 pages on my call. And mainly he's saying, that's true. This is the way forward.
But what a lot of people in France couldn't understand, you went on French television to propose this moratorium. They couldn't understand why you didn't just come out and condemn stoning. I mean, it seems like this ancient barbaric practice. Why wouldn't you just say it's not acceptable?
Yes, I said I am against it and I condemn it in Saudi Arabia, in Nigeria. But, you know, it was a political game with the home minister. They wanted to use that by saying, look, he's not condemning this. And I say, okay, I'm against it. But what I'm trying to do is to open a debate in the Islamic majority countries. So the moratorium, it's something which is the first step to stop and to say, okay, look, open a debate among scholars and ask the scholars, the Muslim scholars, what do the texts say? What are the conditions and in which context? And this is the only way forward. And what happened even in Pakistan, I was called by the Islamic Commission there, and they used the idea of moratorium in one of the cases of this Pakistani-British man who was to be killed, and then they stopped, and he was freed, and they used the concept of moratorium.
But what I've heard is that your call for moratorium got you in a lot of trouble in some countries. It angered a lot of conservative clerics, and didn't Egypt and Saudi Arabia ban you after that?
Saudi Arabia, yes, they banned me after that. Egypt was for another reason, because I am critical towards the regime and say it's not a democracy. But yes, in Saudi Arabia, they said, no, we cannot just talk about this that way, and this is against our religion. And some of the Muslims put me outside the realm of Islam. So my point here is not to please the West or to please the Islamic majority countries or the governments. My point is really to be consistent with my values and the principles of justice.
You said sound very reasonable, and yet you keep getting banned from different countries. I have to ask you about the United States. I mean, why do you think the U.S. State Department canceled your visa? Why have you been banned from this country?
You know, for 2 years, I didn't know. I was asking why, because I got the visa. I was to go to teach at Notre Dame University. Everything was set. I was to go. And then they revoked my visa with no explanation, and they referred to the Patriot Act. So my understanding from the very beginning is that they were unhappy with my political discourse and my views on the American policy. And when
American policy in Iraq and in Israel?
Exactly. When I went first in the American embassy in Switzerland, the questions I got first was about Iraq and about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, because I was saying, look, resistance is legitimate. The means they are using are not, but resistance is legitimate. And your invasion of Iraq was a mistake. It was illegal. So I think that these are the main reasons, but I had no answer till last September. And they came with something which is Tariq Ramadan gave €700 to a Swiss organization which is or was connected to Hamas.
Right.
What they don't say, and which is really important to know, is that this organization is officially recognized by the Swiss government. All the money I gave was just put in my tax application and form, and everything was official, and I gave them money to support schools. The second thing, which is much more important than that, is that I myself told the American embassy that I gave them money, and I gave them money between 1998 and 2002 to help an organization to build schools. And this organization was blacklisted in the States in 2003. So I stopped giving money 1 year before this organization was blacklisted in the States. And I got a letter from the American embassy telling me, you should reasonably have known that this organization was connected to Hamas. It's ridiculous. Hmm. How could I have known this? Mm-hmm. It's not possible. So it's clear for me that this is a pretext. And the true reason is that I'm vocal, I'm speaking loudly against the American policy in the region.
Tariq Ramadan, speaking from the BBC studios in London with Steve Paulson. Ramadan is now a research fellow at Oxford University. His biography of Muhammad is called In the Footsteps of the Prophet.